Hey, good evening, everyone. This is Chuck RK, and welcome to the Bakken Amateur Radio Society Fusion Radio Net. This net operates on the Minnesota, Wisconsin room number 21493. This is an open technical net. Please check in through net control. Tonight's net control stations are November 0, Papa, Andy Oscar Delta Otis, Kilo 9 Echo Quebec, Chris Hades R, NK 0 ORK Chuck. The Bakken Amateur Radio Society takes its name from Earl Bakken, who is the founder of Medtronic. Earl was always interested in radio and is a founding sponsor of the Pavic Museum of Broadcasting. Earl allows us to use his name because he's a strong supporter of learning, experimentation, and helping others. You can learn more about VARS and Earl at www.w0mdt.com. The 444.075 and the 444.525 operate from the Medtronic facility near Highway 10 and I-35W in Minnesota. Remember, there's a chat window available at hamoperator.com, select MinWiz, and then MinWiz chat. Net control will only be taking check-ins from stations with traffic. Please reply with your name, city, and state. We'll acknowledge your call and get it on the list in the order received. Remember, try that chat window if you can't get in. It's available at hamoperator.com. We do have a announcement for the net. Hams in the Park, Long Lake Regional Park, July 10th, starts at noon. Set one up for your home club. Maybe we can join up on the second Saturday of the month from April to October. Is there anybody else with an announcement for the net? Please check in now. All right, hearing no other announcements, we'll start the check-in portion of the net. Remember, we are only taking check-ins from stations with traffic for the net. Questions or comments? If you've got those, give us your name, city, and state. Go ahead now.
This is Whiskey Alpha 1 Echo Sierra Uniform WA1. ESU, Newburyport, Massachusetts, Fred, no traffic.
All right, acknowledging Whiskey Alpha 1 Echo Sierra Uniform, Fred. Thanks for the check-in and saying hello. We'll try it back out there again, looking for check-ins with traffic or comments for the net. If you've got them, this is your chance. Give us your name, city, and state. All right, I think that was November 6, Oscar Kilo. I didn't get a full call sign. It was very broken up. I don't know what you could do to fix it, but try it again.
November 6, Oscar Alpha, Palatka, Florida.
All right, November 6, Oscar Alpha from Florida. Go ahead. What do you got for us?
I'm just here. I wanted to say thanks for being there, and we're listening to the net, and I'm putting it out local VHF channel.
All right. Well, Vincent, I think that's the name. Thank you for putting us out over the net. And looks like you've got an FT-70 and you've got the call sign programmed wrong. It's coming up as QA. So, no November 6th. So. But thanks for listening and thanks for putting it out for other people to listen to. Try it again here. Anybody with comments or questions for the net, give us your name, city, and state. Go ahead now. Well, I have. Oops. I'm not transmitting anymore. I dropped out, so I'm back again, hopefully. I have an FDM-300, and every time I start the truck, the radio turns itself off, and that's getting to be kind of annoying. I was hoping to find some kind of an inverter or something like a Samlink that I could hook into the car, and I'm looking for recommendations to anybody who has done something like that. So if you have, come back to the net and let me know. This is TruckK0RK looking for people to help me out.
Yeah, K9EQ.
Yeah, I dropped out again there, Chuck. Second, I thought you were on the FTM 300 and driving around and whatever. I did see your message about the Samlex. It's basically the unit is it takes 9 to 18 volts and. Whatever the input voltage, it makes, 13.8 or 12 volts or, you can adjust the output a little bit. I put it at about 12.5. And it's good for up to 16 amps. And I know DX Engineering has them. I thought Ham Radio Outlet might be carrying them now. They're a pretty neat little device. But I think you might be able to solve the problem without using that. If the battery's getting below 9 volts, that's pretty serious. But it would definitely, smooth everything out. One of the advantages to it is that the Yaesu mobile radios don't need 13.8. Even on high power, it used to be back in the day, or with ICOM, you had to have exactly 13.8 or you didn't make full power out. Well, that's not true with the Yaesu radios. In fact, they'll do full power output down to about 12 volts or so, and the extra 1.8 or some car charging systems go to 15.4. All that extra voltage times current, it just equals extra heat in the radio. I can dig up that part number here and get back to you with that, Chuck. Although I think, there might be other ways to solve it with, capacitors and stuff like that. The Samlex would definitely do it. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what the voltage is actually doing in these cars. Anyway, we've talked about the FTM 300 and it's doing that reset thing in the back, so I won't go into it anymore, but it's a property of the restart or reset circuitry on the processor. I'll get that information for you, Chuck, here before the nut's over. K9EQ.
All right, Chris, just a little background on that. Got a new AGM battery, the largest one that I could put in the tray. I'm not sure what it is. It's in a Tacoma with a V6. But I got the biggest one I could fit in there. And I have direct wire, 10-gauge wire, from the battery via the fuses. I put two fuses in line, one on the positive, one on the negative. Direct to the battery or to the radio. So I don't know why there would be so much voltage drop there, but it just doesn't matter whether the car's hot, cold, whatever. Whenever I turn the car on, the radio drops. I could probably even have a battery charger on the thing and it'd still drop out. So I'm kind of voting that it's maybe a little bit of a design flaw, that it doesn't like any kind of a voltage drop, but it gets annoying when you're counting on it, you jump out of the truck, you jump back in, and then you realize 15 minutes later that you don't hear anybody talking anymore. So that's why I put out my request, and if I get it solved, I will definitely share it with the rest of the net. Looking for anybody else who might have a problem that they would like to have checked out. If you've got comments or questions, problems, name, city, state, go ahead now.
And I have those part numbers for you, Chuck. And I've got a question for you, Chuck. VK5JP, because I run a 300 and don't have any of those issues.
All right. I see we've got VK5 Julie Papa. And Chris, you said you had some part numbers for me. If you've got them, I'll take those, and then we'll go on to Pete. So, Chris, go ahead.
Okay. Looks like DX Engineering might be drop shipping them or something, because all of the Samlux stuff says we'll ship on June 29th. But the Samlux, S-A-M-L-E-X, the part number is IDC, as in I, current, DC, direct current, IDC-200, A-alpha-12, and what this is a fully isolated converter. I mean, this thing is amazing that, you know, you can just leave it connected to the battery all the time, and it pulls so little current when it's, nobody's pulling current out of it, or very small current out of it. I don't know how they do it. Anyway, it's, if you go look that up, the IDC-200A-12, it is, nominal 12 volt out, the -12, and, 16 amps, the 200, I believe, is 200 watts. They also have a slightly cheaper 8-amp version, but for $20 more, I'd get the 16-amp version. The thing is built like a brick. I mean, the thing is just absolutely fantastic construction, rugged as all get out. And that would probably do it for you. Like I say, I think I've had to go to DX Engineering for this part, but it might be that Ham Radio Outlet is also carrying them. You can also get a 30-amp unit, but that pretty much doubles the price of it. DX Engineering is advertising it for $164.60. So there you go, about twice that for the 30-amp unit. These are also good for HF rigs running off of lead-acid batteries, because what lead-acid battery ever gives you 13.8 volts? Answer, none. It does come set for 12 volts DC out. You can adjust that up or down a bit there. So I think you have to take a panel off, but there's a little, a little pot in there that you can adjust and run the voltage up or down if you want, and it will go up to 13.8. So anyway, there you go, Chuck. Hopefully that answers the question, and maybe VK5JP is driving a different car or something. So anyway, interesting to see what these cars do when they when the starter kicks in. Just put a scope on them or something and see what the battery voltage does. One thing I forgot to mention, Chuck, this might be one of those cases where you make the problem worse by wiring directly to the battery. You know, if you tap the power off of, you know, some DC, you know, outlet thingy or whatever, there might be enough inductance and stuff in the wiring and whatever to the FTM 300 wouldn't see the quick drop in current. Don't know. Anyway, don't have an FTM 300. Never seen one. Back to you, Chuck, K9EQ.
All right, Chris, thank you for that. I will look into it and see what I can do. VK5, Julie Papa, Pete, Adelaide, Australia. Pete, what do you got for us tonight?
Hey, good evening, Chuck, and everyone listening. First up, the wiring. Have you got it wired in the vehicle? Because, you know, listening to the problems that you've got, I don't see any of those issues. I can leave my radio on. I have programmed up the battery monitoring on that radio, and I can see the voltage swing between when the battery's not being charged and when the alternator switches on. And I can see when the voltage is dropped down to about 11 volts. Now, I admittedly have got a brand new battery in the vehicle, sounds like you have as well. But one of the things I found from the Ford dealership is that the alternators only work on demand. And therefore, the alternator is not on, and so the vehicle spends most of its time running on battery, and the alternator only cuts in when required. Now, the other thing I also said, you do not wire your radio across the battery terminals. One leg, and that is only the positive side. The other goes to the common ground chassis. I have had no issues with it while I'm cranking the motor over. Voltage does drop a little bit, but it doesn't affect the 300 whatsoever. Do not lose memories or anything like that. It doesn't even have any adverse effects when the car goes to start up. So the biggest thing too is these batteries also got sensors now on both the positive and negative, and that's why, again, they recommend that you only do one side, and that is the positive to the battery. If the sensor blows, your radio becomes the new fuse on the battery. So it's very important to only have one leg, not both legs across the battery there, Chuck. Back to you.
Yep, thank you, Pete. And that is exactly how I have it wired. The ground wire is at the junction block on the firewall, where there's another wire that goes down to the motor. So there, it's all in the ground, chassis ground wiring there, and it's only the positive wire that goes direct to the battery. I'm sorry, I might have misunderstood that. The thing is my FTM-400 never had an issue with this. The only change I made here was I changed it from a 400 to a 300, and this has started. So, not sure what's going on, but I'm going to keep trying to run it down. Anybody else with a comment or a question for the net? If you've got one, give us your name, city, and state.
Rick, this is Kilo Bravo 7, Romeo Foxtrot Tango from Jerome, Idaho. And mine goes from 11.5 volts when the car is in idle to 14 volts when I'm pushing on the throttle. KV7R.
All right, acknowledging KV7RFT, Kelly from Idaho. Kelly, you need to turn your audio down a little bit. You are just booming in here. And appreciate that. What that tells me is that your alternator, or however it's being excited, is not working the way it's supposed to. Something's not perfect on your car, but good to know that it works for you. And hey, that's what it's all about, trying different stuff. So, I've got a voltmeter, so what I'm going to do is hook the voltmeter into something so that I can see it from the driver's seat while I key it and see how far down that voltage actually goes. See where it hits that shutoff thing. All right. If anybody else has got a comment or a question for the net, go ahead now. Name, city, and state. The correct way to do it is to wait till you're acknowledged from net control. We'll tell you to take it. You talk, then send it back to net control. Go ahead now.
Kilo November 4, Golf Juliet Victor. Kilo November 4, Golf Juliet Victor.
Kilo November 4, Golf Juliet Victor, Richard, Wintergreen or Winter Garden, Florida. Go ahead, what do you got for us this evening?
Well, I appreciate the comeback. I had just set up my HRI node, and I heard the net, and I just wanted to make sure that I'm communicating. It's kind of like a radio check, but appreciate you coming back to me and verifying that. And I don't want to take up any more time than that. Thank you very much. KN4, BGJV, are you getting clearly?
All right. Your HRI 200 seems to be working, and you have a good evening also. This is the Bakken Amateur Radio Society, Technical Net. If you've got a comment or question for the Technical Net, give us your name, city, and state. Go ahead.
N-A-D-S-H, Ted in Dublin, Ohio.
November 8, Alpha Sierra Hotel, Ted, Dublin, Ohio. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question about feed lines. Wondering what everybody's using. Are they using, like, LRM 600 on a 100-foot tower with a Yaesu repeater?
Well, I guess the best answer to that one is how deep is your pocket? The less loss that you have on a 100-foot tower and the rest of the way to your house or wherever the repeater is located, the better off you're going to be. So, like 7/8 hard line or 1.5 inch hard line, but that takes a really deep pocket. LMR 600, excellent choice if that's what you got. Even LMR 400, but you're going to give, every time you go down in size, you give up some more loss. So, you know, it's a trade-off between dollars and cents and loss in the feed line. Back to you, Ted.
Yeah, one guy suggested the hard line, but I thought it wasn't that big of an advantage in a 100-foot run, but maybe I need to look at it again. Yeah, we're probably going to go with, we'll go with at least LMR 600, and if need be, we'll go with the hard line.
Well, let's see. I got a little note here. It says, repeater diehards say never use LMR for a repeater because the foil can cause intermod noise. I didn't know that, so I'm learning something else here. For the best installation is hardline. There's no question about it. It is the most expensive way to go, but it's also the best way, and the most of the time you can reuse the connectors and the hardline in other things. It doesn't go bad. Unlike the LMR, after a few years out in the weather, it's pretty much, it, you don't want to move it, it'll be just fine where it is, but don't think about moving it. Back to you, Ted.
Okay, well, that answers that question. Thanks a lot. N-A-D-S-H, back to net.
Well, we have another opinion checking in here. Chris, K9EQ, you've got something for us. And we've got also Otis, Whiskey 40 Oscar Delta. So, okay. Chris, go ahead. What do you got on a second opinion?
Yeah, well, Pete made the comment that, well, the way, let me back up, the way LMR 400 is built is you have a center conductor, and you have their best attempt at air around the center conductor. They use a foam material that has a high percentage of the mass of the foam is actually air that's in the foam. And then you have a fairly dense wire braid that wraps around that. And then there's a foil that is on that. And then you have the black coating on the outside. You can have issues with repeaters when there's RF energy and you have two dissimilar metals in contact with each other. The two dissimilar metals will act like a diode and the diode is a rectifier, and it can take your RF energy and rectify it and cause all manner of problems. And oftentimes you'll hear that on a repeater. If somebody's keyed up and you hear this crackling in the background, that's probably what's going on. Different antennas, like the Superstation Masters and stuff, have really bad problems with that. So the belief was then that you can't use LMR 400 for a feed line for a repeater. In fact, the way the cable is built, if you were to examine it real carefully, there is a coating that's put on the braid, I think it is, which provides an insulator between the foil and the braid. And so down the length of the cable, there isn't any electrical contact between the foil and the braid. You know, since they're supposed to both be at 0 volts or pretty close to it, it's not going to puncture through. It's pretty thin coating between the two. Then, of course, the two come together at the connectors at each end and get terminated into the outer shield at the end. Where you can run into problems is if you happen to overflex the cable. So like LMR 400 has a maximum or minimum, I don't know how you look at it, bend radius of 18 inches. So if you take the cable and it gets bent more than 18 inches, I would not use that for a repeater. if you have the Ultraflex, you can bend it a little tighter than that. If the cable is going to be abused, like if it's on a roof and people are going to walk on it, then that gets a little sketchy too. So a part of this is you need to be nice to the cable. A hard line is preferred if you are able to get it and use it. It's lower loss. And the note here on the internet was that LMR 600 connectors are expensive. Yeah, they're expensive. Nothing like hardline connectors, though. Hardline connectors are, you know, minimum $50 a piece, something like that. And so the way hardline is really built is it's hard. So you typically have a copper center conductor, whereas the LMR 400 is kind of a multiple stranded copper wires. The hard line typically consists of a copper tube, so it's hollow on the inside, and you have copper, and that's a skin effect thing. You know, we don't care how much copper is there because the signals travel over the skin. And then there is a sort of a corrugated solid copper shield. And then you have spacers in the cable to keep the copper tube in the center centered, and then the corrugation of the shield allows you to bend it. And it has even a smaller larger bend radius than like the LMR 400. It's you want to be extremely careful working with the hard line, but it is lower loss just because it has less stuff. And, the copper shield is a little nicer, so that helps. But typically people run like 7/8 hard line, so you're probably looking at $5-6 a foot, if you get a deal. And then, like I say, $50 to $75 for a connector, something like that. But the real serious repeater installations will use the hard line. But you can do fine with the LMR 400, but I would admonish that every connector, every jumper cable, everything on the RF side of that of the repeater is very important. And you have anything sketchy with the duplexer or something like that, you're just going to have no end of trouble. And also the dielectric problem doesn't have to be with the repeater. It can be something that's near the repeater. It could be the tower that the antenna is on and things like that. So there are a lot of things that factor into this, but you can use LMR 400, and the loss that you're willing to tolerate just depends upon your system design, how long the run is. Maybe it's a short run, or maybe if you lose 5 or 6 dB, it's not a big deal. It depends on what the repeater is supposed to do. Anyway, back to you, Chuck, K9EQ.
Thank you, Chris. And then off to Otis, Whiskey 4 in your Oscar Delta. Go ahead.
All right, Chuck. Well, I guess everyone has an opinion on this, and it's a good question on Ted as far as what feed line to use. Well, for me, it also makes a difference, just to add to something that Chris was saying, whether you're running, whether you're the frequencies you're operating on are UHF or VHF. And for me, it's UHF here in Kentucky. And I've had a wealth or a plethora of information from a couple of friends here in Kentucky, KC4FIE and KB4PGJ, when I was initially installing my UHF repeater. And one of the things that you look at, things are not equal when it comes to duplexing. And that's one thing you'll find out real quick. So for me, 7/8 hardline, the Heliax, the Andrew, and Lynn K7LW over on the Minwiz chat room is actually making reference to, yes, it's expensive. Well, it only costs a few dollars more to go first class, too. And sometimes you actually get what you pay for, so. The skin factor with the Heliax and yes, the connectors are expensive. Everything's expensive. But for the jumpers, I primarily use the RG214s. They're not cheap either. They're double braided. And when you're doing repeater, you are duplexing, which means you are transmitting and receiving at the same time. So that added double shield or at double braid makes a big difference. So yeah, you can get by with it for a while on UHF, but I found with a higher frequency, you're going to run into problems over the course of the time. So it's sometimes it's just my opinion, but it's best to spend a little money and invest in it, and then you'll get more satisfaction over the long haul, so to speak. So I think 214 is about $7 or $8 a foot. It's one of the things that we use for jumpers here, and then, like I said, we use the Heliax on the repeater. That's just my opinion for what it's worth, and Chuck, appreciate you taking time to let me voice my opinion and share it with Annette. W4IOD, back to net control.
All right, well, there you go. A bunch of different opinions on how to do it. Ted, anything that you'd like to add on to that feed line question?
No, I think they about summed it up. So I guess I'll have to look at my budget and go with that. Good info. Thanks a lot. NADSH, back to that.
Thank you for a great question, because I know there's lots of people out there that want to be repeater owners, and lots of repeater owners that are saying, well, you know, let's all learn. That's what we're here for. This is Chuck K0RK with the Bakken Amateur Radio Society Fusion Radio Net. And to TechNet, name, city, state, if you've got a question, go ahead.
VK5JP, again, I've got a question for Chris regards the new Dell Inspirion. Back to you, Net Control.
All right, Pete, thank you very much. And Chris, question direct to you. So, K9EQ, go ahead. Okay, Pete, what was the question?
I know we've had this topic discussed many a time before, but one of the chappies here rang me yesterday, and I couldn't help him out, but he's bought a brand new Dell Inspirion, I think it's now not, but anyway, it's a 15, 55, 10, it's got an i7 processor. He installed the WiseX, and it keeps up, coming up and asking him to recheck the sound card. Now, I think you discussed this once before. You know, I went through everything I could think of, but I could not come up with an answer. He did have the analog side of it in, but when I questioned him. He wasn't interested in that side, so he removed it. But I tried to get him back up the sound card, but it still kept coming up with the question about checking the sound card. It's a brand new unit. It's only a week old, but yeah, for the love of God, I couldn't come up with any answers for him. We tried uninstalling the YSX, reinstalling with the driver, then the YSX, but still nothing. But you can see the driver, and that's not a problem, but it just can't seem to get the sound card to activate. Back to you there, Chris.
Okay, very good. I don't know precisely what's going on, but the WireSec software is definitely happier if there's a sound card. What happens on the newer computers, and that is they can detect whether you have anything plugged into the sound card. And what is probably happening is that since nothing's plugged into the sound card, that detection is not made, and so the sound card is disabled. Why have a sound card in your computer if there's nothing plugged into it? Or logic like that. And so what some people have done is they've just plugged something into it, just like a 3.5 millimeter, phone connector type of thing, and just not hanging there, not connected to anything. And that then enables the sound card, and so when WireSec starts up, it looks for the sound card, and it's happy. Everybody's happy. What I've kind of suggested for people, I mean, there is an advantage to hooking up the analog. For example, MinWiz is a mixed mode room. And so the analog, if you don't have the analog connected, you won't hear the analog stations, and they won't hear you, admittedly. Not many analog stations on MinWiz. Some other places, that might be a bigger deal. But he'll have to have his PDN in the mixed mode, which requires the analog to even connect to MinWiz. If he has it in the digital-only mode, he'll only be able to connect to rooms that are digital-only. So just a caveat there. I think if he just does something to enable the sound card, like plugging something into the mic input, it will then turn on. And I guess what I was going to say, too, is my recommendation is to get a little USB sound adapter and use that with the WireSec and stuff like that. Because you may want to use the sound card in the computer for making computer sounds or something. And that would allow you to have WireSec pretty much independent of the computer sound card. They're like $5 or $6. There's not much to them. But I think that's what you'll find is you need to have it enabled. Of course, if you just take one of these USB sound card things and just plug it in and get a cheap one. Expensive ones are probably too fancy. And you plug it in, the computer's probably going to go, looky gee, there's a sound card. Everybody's happy too. So, anyway, something along that line, I suggest, Pete, or you, Chuck, K9EQ.
Kilo November 4, Golf Juliet Victor, comment.
All right. Chris, thank you for turning it back to me. And Pete, I need to acknowledge Kilo November 4 and Golf Juliet Victor for the comment. We will get back to you. But first it's going to go to Pete, Victor Kilo 5, Julie Papa. Did that answer your question?
I lost connection when Chris came back. Sorry, I've got to get you to reiterate, Chris. I didn't realize my connection had dropped off. I'm not sure if you've even got the second part of the question that I shot to you, but I'll just go back. That newer laptop has only got the one output. I presume it's dual, and it does both speaker and mic. As I said, I don't know enough about this new unit. Another question I had was the plugging itself. Do you have to short it out, or do you just leave it as is and just plug it straight in? Sorry to make you go back over that, Chris. It was the top of my end internet hiccup. Back to you there, Chris.
Yeah, pesky internet. Yeah, you can just plug a 3.5 millimeter or whatever phone jack in there. It doesn't have to have anything wired to it. The sound cards just detect if a plug has been plugged in, and then they turn themselves on. I mean, it's done through the driver, right? But that's typically the problem. If you go in, the other thing you can do is go into the device manager, and you can look there to see if you have a sound card. And I'm going to guess that, you know, if you don't plug something into the computer, it's going to indicate that there's no sound card in the device manager. And if you just plug a jack into the, say, the microphone or line input, something like that, you'll probably see the device manager flip around, and suddenly there's the sound device sitting there. I don't think that's done on the output, that sensing whether you have something plugged in, just on the input. So I guess the idea is you could plug in different things, and if it can figure out what's being plugged in, it can automatically switch things around and save you the pesky problem of clicking on a button, and it just goes and changes it for you and leaves you wondering what happened, I guess. The Windows philosophy. Back to you, Chuck, K90Q.
All right, Chris, thank you again. And let's try Richard. Kilo November 4, Golf Juliet Victor. Why don't you go ahead? You had a comment on this.
Thank you. Rick here. I've been down that path also with one computer not recognizing the sound card and others recognizing it. And personally, I've tried plugging headphones in, and in Windows 10, you'll see a speaker on the lower right-hand corner with a, like, sound bars next to it to indicate that it likes the sound that you've plugged into, in other words, headphones. However, I believe it's a USB problem. Not recognizing the USB correctly through the prolific interface that causes that. The reason I say that is that in the HRI mode, and also in the PDN mode, it uses the USB cable for audio. And if it doesn't recognize that USB connection, for example, the computer may be USB 2 and the radio may be USB 3, that may be causing the problem too. So I've had machines that recognize it immediately and put the little speaker on the lower right-hand corner in Windows 10, and older machines never recognize the audio card, even though there is one and the speaker is lit on the right side and the headphones work just properly. So something tells me in the way they design the software, if the USB isn't being correctly recognized or exercised, that'll cause the problem too. Back to net control, see what you guys think.
All right, Rick, thank you very much. You bring up some really good points. And, yeah, that's the fun of a new computer, is the learning experience on how to get everything to listen to each other again. I think we kind of beat that one up, so let's move on, see if there's anybody else out there that would like to join the net with a comment or a question. Name, city, and state. All right, hearing nothing, I'm going to bring the net to an end. Had some excellent questions tonight, lots of good feedback. Thanks to all the hams helping other hams. This is Chuck K0HORK, and thank everybody for listening to the Bakken Amateur Radio Society Fusion Radio Net. Remember, we meet here every Monday night at 7:30 Central Time to cover all things Fusion. Please allow 1 minute for rooms that wish to disconnect before resuming use of the room. Again, K0HORK,
And I'll be clear. Everybody have a great week.
Chuck, can you hang around for a bit? I want to chat with you a bit more about your 300 VK Foster VP.
Sure, let me get a couple things tied up here, and I will be right back, Pete. Hang on.
Hey, Roger, standing by. And good morning to you too, Chris. Well, good evening, I should say. Sent a couple of pictures to you while you're talking about the problems with cables. We found at our repeater site while we're having a myriad of problems. We put a tester on and found we had problems all along the cable. Water had actually egressed into the cable. It amazed us to no end.
Oh, well, you know, you point out the an issue with hardline. And that is, the hardline. Well, you did a nice job of cutting it open. But, yeah, you get water in there and you're a goner. And you have just a tiny hole, microscopic hole in the hardline that you can't spot. And it's all over. So, that might be one of the cases. I forgot about that as a disadvantage of hardline, but you really want to keep the hardline dry. It's almost like you'd want positive pressure, like, you know, the broadcasters do.
Hey, Roger, Chris. They're all commercial TV stations. So it's a big problem. And we discovered we've got the same issue. We call them flying secateurs. Parrots and cockatoos. Those beaks of theirs, they only have to put a small gash into the side of the cable, and that's it. But apparently at the commercial site, it's an ongoing thing. We've been left alone, but we were tearing our hair out because we couldn't see anything visibly. So we pulled up the van up alongside the tower and the cable into the van because we had the test gear in there, and it was starting to show us some things that we were fearing. So anyway, we took that whole run out. And we were surprised that we couldn't see anything untoward at the top where the cockatoos had gotten to just where it was heat shrunk. They had a bit of the chew there, but where we found the water was more down towards the bottom end, and we couldn't see anything as such, but. As you said, it only needs like a pinhole, and that water can certainly do a fair bit of damage. So in the end, we end up replacing the whole run. So far, so good, but that's the other problems. It must cost the guys up in the commercial networks quite a considerable amount, because the muggers are forever chewing at the cables back to you.
You know, they probably patch it, and they also know when they're having a problem because ideally they should be able to shut off the nitrogen tank and the pressure should just stay constant. But, you know, usually what happens, they look at their nitrogen tank and it's supposed to be at 2,000 PSI and it's down to 1,500, and it's like, okay, we got a problem. So they'll go leak checking and patch the hole. The way you would check that problem, and I've had problems. I had a badly manufactured coax. The coax was in fine shape. It just was incredibly lossy per foot. What you can do is if you disconnect or short the cable at the far end, you can look at the return loss on it, and that'll tell you
two times the loss in the cable. And you know what it's supposed to be, so if it's greater than that, you know that needs a more serious work. And it's still 50 ohms, right? It's just that your dielectric isn't air anymore. Anyway, maybe Chuck's in here, and kind of interested in this FTM300 thing, because people have mentioned it on the net. And it's not the actual voltage, I don't think. It's the rate of change of the voltage that triggers the device. I don't have a schematic of the 300. I could look into it more otherwise, but I suspect they changed that circuitry, and it's a DVDT kind of thing. So go ahead, Chuck, if you're there.
I think he said he had to attend to a couple of things before he came back. That's got me mystified. Why his is pulling down like that? I don't see that problem occurring on mine. Or the 400 for that fact. I have heard some of the other guys here say that when they crack the car over, sort of pulls the radio down a little bit before it jumps up. But if I remember reading somewhere that he shouldn't have done anything to it. Well, but these things are not like the old radios and that, where the on and off, was physically, the radio was off. As we all know, these things are now soft start. The radio is always on. But I'm intrigued that it pulls it down that far, that causes him that many problems. I've watched the voltage swing downwards, it hasn't affected it. But the biggest thing that they emphasised on the Ford dealership somewhere was the actual connection. Now, I'm not sure if he's actually on the battery or he's using a pole on that, because like in the Ford, I also got spots where I can go in and plug the radio directly in. But I bypass those and I only went directly to the battery. Now, also on my battery, I've got a diode rectifier. The reason why that thing is there, which I discovered later onwards, was that there is a PA system in the vehicle. The factory fitted it, and then they fitted this humongous diode in there. And I went, hey, this is a good place to connect onto. And so I don't seem to have any of the issues, but I don't, every car is different. And I don't know whether he's driving a pickup or whatever, so wiring is going to be different from one vehicle to the other. But I'm really curious as to why it seems to pull it down so far. Back to you there, Chris.
Okay. Well, like I was saying, it isn't the absolute voltage, so... the way these circuits work is if they see a sudden fall in voltage, even though it's 13.8 and it's falling to 11, let's say, it may pull the reset line. And you can set those parameters. The idea is that you want to have enough power left for the microcontroller to shut down properly and do a full reset. And I suspect that Bruce has had enough problems with partial resets, sort of, messed up memory or something like that, but they're trying to be safer about it. The way I envision this is that when the starter starts, it's actually pulling power out of the radio, so it's gone into the battery, hooked to the battery, and it's pulling all this current out of the battery. The battery voltage drops, and then as a consequence of that, it just sucks power out of the radio, all the little capacitors and inductance and all that stuff along the way, and then the radio sucks all the energy out of that and creates a fast DVDT. So you
one idea is like that. If you use a diode, you can have hopefully one of these like a Schottky diode. They have lower voltage on it. Of course, with the AC radios, they work fine with a lower voltage, so, who cares? Because the Schottky diode won't get as hot, when you pull 10 amps out of it. But go through a diode and then have some reasonably good sized capacitor on the radio side of the diode. That means take care of the problem right there, because you're going to be able to store low energy, so you're going to be able to keep the radio running for a little bit. And really what you're trying to do is cushion the effects of that UVDT rapid fall in voltage. And it's going to be, you have a hard time knowing what the starter is doing to the battery without using an oscilloscope on it. Just the voltage is going to change so quickly, and you're looking for those, you're looking at the, probably the microsecond level to see what that voltage is doing. The scope would be able to point out where, the absolute minimum that voltage got to, where the meter is something that gets averaged over a long period of time. You're not going to see it on the meter, I don't think. Anyway, so, that's what I think it is just that UVDT, and it might be that, like you were saying, that diode that you have in your truck or vehicle is all it needs.
To the voltage swings and that, and as the mic. Question is can you get someone else with a 300 and plug it into the vehicle and see if he has the same problem? Let me tell you there, Chris, it was for the Chuck there.
Okay, something was going on there, Pete, and on the hotspot now. I was listening to you on the hotspot here to see if that was any better. Pretty much didn't copy any of that. Not sure why. You were fine before, and then there was this, horrendous packet loss.
What am I coming through right now? It's strange. Had this problem pop up the other day. We're coming through clear now.
Yeah, it was fine that time.
Yeah, I had the same when you came across the floor. It was terrible. So I don't know. Got all internet I was just saying, I was wondering if there was someone that close by where they could exchange the monitors and just see if it has the same problem, because the question that I keep coming back to is, why did the 400 work so well? And I would say that he had wired the 300 exactly the same as he had done the 400 in the past and had no issues. Why is the 300 giving him so much grief? The other question I had is the voltage sensing circuit in the 300 a lot more sensitive that behaves the way that it is. It's fine when the voltage is static, but since it changes, it causes him all sorts of grief. You would have thought the radios would have been, I won't say 100% bulletproof, but would have been certainly designed as such that they could deal with those cranking voltages changing so rapidly. Back to you.
Yeah, well, I expect it's a different design in the 300. Like I say, I don't know if the design did change. The prior to the 300, it was done via the circuitry that's embedded within the microcontroller itself. And those are typically voltage threshold type things that go on. And there was probably some circuitry driving it now that I think about it. But you know, you're in this game where you don't want to shut down unnecessarily, but you want to shut down fast enough that you don't scramble the brains of the computer. And people really get annoyed when you scramble the brains of the computer, because in some cases the radio gets sent back to YAESU versus you having to turn it back on again. So that's the challenge, is to, in all these different electrical environments, is try to design a circuit that's going to reliably send a signal to the processor to shut down before the power gets so low that the processor fails to operate correctly. It does seem like it's a little overly sensitive, because, I mean, one of the ways you would typically do that is you take your input voltage and you've got some regulator and some, you know, big old caps, relatively speaking, and you power the microcontroller off that regulator, so if the power does go down, you've got plenty of power to run the microcontroller for, maybe a dozen or so milliseconds or whatever it takes to shut down. That would probably be the way to do it. Maybe somebody at YAESU got clever, I don't know. But Chuck's not the only one having this problem, so I don't think it's to do with Chuck's individual radio. I think it's his radio and his vehicle just are not happy with each other, and the system here is sensitive enough that, you know, that makes a difference. I mean, there's a world of difference between what different starter motors pull. I know in my Honda, it had this little tiny starter motor, you know, and then the pair that was going to, how could you pull, you know, too much power with a starter motor that's small. Hang on a second, I got to take a call here.
Hey, Roger, Chris, standing by.
Stupid pharmacy. Trying to refill a prescription that shouldn't be refilled. Anyway. There you go. Yeah, there's something. It'd be interesting to look at the schematic of the 300 and see what they did and get some data. But like I was saying, I think some vehicles, the starter motors take a lot more power than others. Because like the Honda, had a tiny little car battery and never had a problem with it in the coldest winters. And I've seen other vehicles that have much bigger starters in them. You know, so I don't know. I think it has to do with a lot of things, but you know, even with Chuck, though, putting in the biggest battery he could get, still having the problem, that sucks.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, well, until a few months back, my battery was slowly, surely dying. I was very much putting it on the charge. I've got a full territory, which looks similar to one of your big ones over there. And this thing's got a 4-liter six in it. So she's got a quick old starter motor on it. Despite the fact that the battery was dying and, I really pulled it way down. My 300 just sat there and just, said, yeah, okay. I watched the voltage drop down to below 11 volts. And the display actually is reasonably accurate, which was surprising. I got my meter out and clamped it on, put it so I could see, I could look up and see the meter as I was cranking the car over. And anyway, I was very surprised at the voltage reading on the 300 displayed pretty much spot on that. It's a little circuit that enables you to be able to read the car's voltage is obviously been well designed. And that's because the multimeter I use is not a cheap one by any stretch of the imagination. It's a rather expensive unit. It had to be for the work I was doing. And I thought, this radio is certainly taking a fair bit of punishment. it didn't seem to be affected even by a bad battery. So, I don't know, it's got me mystified why you guys are having problems with it. But maybe I was just lucky enough and got a good one, I don't know. But that's certainly not the pulling it right down. I was down to about 2.5, where basically the car just wasn't going to crank over anyway. But the radio, I was still receiving. I was yelling out to the chaps. I said, hey, stand by. I've got battery problems. Back to you.
Yeah, as it turns out, you can... I know on the FTM-400, let's say you your battery slowly discharges, the 400 will not see that, and the voltage will get low enough that the radio won't operate correctly, and then scramble the brains of the computer. So people have found that when, they left their car at the airport for a month and come back and the battery's dead. And then the FTM-400 that needs to do the factory reset thing. So that's happened. There are limits. I think the controller in the 400s and 300s is a 5-volt device. And using a linear voltage regulator, that means it needs at least 8 volts. You start to maybe get around to down to 7, you're pushing your luck. And of course the analog circuitry isn't going to work very well because, the analog circuitry is designed to work with a much higher voltage, so sensitivity is going to be garbage and, a bunch of other things like that. So there's certain voltages at which, the radio just shouldn't be operated. But I'm sure it's something like that that's going on. It's been reported by a lot of people. Having problems like this. This has been especially, there are a lot of cars now where the engine, I think it's called idle stop or whatever, where you get into a mode where you don't need the engine and the engine will just stop and then it'll start again, like when you put your foot on the gas and off you go. There's some people that have those cars that their radio is constantly resetting, Every time they put their foot on the gas, the radio resets. That's really annoying.
Mazdas come to mind, they've got that. And unfortunately, I don't. There's a book and sitting at the big lights and that down the and that they were sort of frightened and shut off. I don't know, they got up electronic system that's I came across that article from Fort and it was quite interesting to read because when I had the old Mitsubishi the old rule of thumb was, hey, let's hang it across the battery, you know, on that within both ends of it. But the old car didn't have the sophisticated electronics like the newer cars, and that's what worried me. And that I thought, geez, how am I going to wire this thing into this vehicle? And that, because all of a sudden there's all these blessed voltage sensors around the vehicle, and I had no idea what was happening in the outlet boxes. Where you have the accessories and that, a lot of cases you can plug radios into there. Well, I bypassed all of that in the end. I decided that I wouldn't risk it and I would go one terminal to the battery. I originally, by mistake, totally without conscious thought, I wired it up like the old car. And on analog, I was forever getting the buzz, and I could not figure it out. And then when I come across the article about wiring up in the Ford, and they emphasise about connecting to the common chassis ground, and I thought, uh-oh. I quickly removed the negative side and put it there, and it didn't... an unexpected thing, that buzz suddenly disappeared, and I worked it out that I must have been there getting it. Hang on, I'll just reset. Now, I must have been there getting a bit of buzz from the alternator, because having changed it, just doing that simple thing, cleaned up the analog side of it quite nicely. I never did notice it on the digital, but certainly on the analog. But that, having done that, also negated the sensors there as well. These vehicles nowadays have got so many darn sensors in them as well on that for various things. And they run more on battery than they do on their alternators there. Only do give it a bit of a top up. The other thing I really look to is, which will be one of our car mechanics electronics, the new cars, and they beefed up the charging voltage because they discovered that the charge on demand, the voltage that was being delivered wasn't enough. So they bumped them up from 14.8 to 15.8, so they're now putting out a much higher charge. Back to you there, Chris.
Okay, yeah, it's a lot of monitoring out there. A lot of controllers and things. And I did notice here in the States there's a shortage of microcontrollers, some of the automotive manufacturers are removing the idle start feature because presumably that's not really essential, and they can take that microcontroller and build another car with it that doesn't have idle start in it. So tracking these things down can be a little pesky. But power supply problems are tricky, and there's a lot of them. Without an oscilloscope, you just can't see what's going on. So anyway, I better get going here. I've got a few things to get done, but hopefully Chuck will show up and get your get more information on the situation there. I was hoping for a solution that wouldn't involve him buying a Samlex converter. You know, the diode and the capacitor sounds a little cheaper to me, and you know, if that works, then you know, and that would be recommended.
I suppose it would be a good starting point, that's sure. Right, Chris, I hadn't tried to chase you up because the last couple of weeks you've either been caught up with talking about video cameras and set with a guy in New Zealand or somebody else has bent your ear, and I just sat back and listened. But anyway, I better let you up, and hope you guys... I think Matt brought it up, saying that you guys are heading into a bit of a 2-year drought period. I'm not sure if it's affecting you, but they're saying so back here, California, 2 years of drought. Back to you, just quickly.
Yeah, all the year we moved here, it rained like crazy. This year, I think we had pretty much normal rainfall last year. I'm not sure. We got about half that this year, but yeah, California's been through periods of 7 years, stuff like that. There's a lot of issues. A lot of people depend on the Colorado River for the water, mostly Arizona, Nevada, California, you know, Colorado, Utah. And probably not Utah so much. That's really looking pretty low. Like there's two major hydroelectric dams on the Colorado River, and you know they're both looking at shutting down power. And I think Las Vegas pretty much gets most of its power and its water from the Colorado River. And so it'll be interesting to see how Las Vegas makes out. Yeah, there's stuff going on. Some areas are doing it better than others. Oceanside, which is a city close to us, they've gone to a sewage reclamation process where they can create 5.5 million gallons of water a day by processing the sewage, which is fine. You know, pure water is pure water. You can't tell where it came from. And there's also a fairly large desalinization plant that is operating. About a third of our water comes from the ocean through the desalinization plant. And so they're working on water conservation and new sources for water. I mean, we have close to minimal water usage here. Most of the plants are designed for arid. And we just have a very small lawn about the size of my kitchen table, but we might even get rid of that and just replace it with artificial turf. So, yeah, people are pretty conscious about water use.
Yeah, we went through this quite a while back, but they had a knee-jerk reaction and took a while to build the desal plant, but they converted an old refinery over to utilize it for desalination. And we're getting quite a bit because our Murray River is in the same state at the moment. That's not enough flow, hadn't been enough rain, and yet the East Coast has had the hell out of it, knocked out of it with storms and all the rest of it, and flooding and all the rest of it, but it doesn't seem to find its way into the river. Here we are. We're starting our winter, and we've had a couple of rains, but they're not widespread enough, and we were having a bit of a drive, and we're looking at the wetlands, and they're still dry.
usually by now, we can get a good indication if the wetlands are filled up with water. We're going to have a pretty good year, but no, she's been pretty dry. But forecast 100% rain today, and believe it or not, sunshine. I can't seem to get it right. Anyway, listen, I'll let you go. Great talking with you as always, and I'll catch up with you somewhere at the Memphis and talk some more. And trust the home renos are going slowly and surely. K90Q, VK5JP73 is Chris. Thanks for the time.
Hi, we're making progress. We actually have a stove to cook things on and a refrigerator to put cold beer in. So, oh, we got an oven, too. Forgot about that. Anyway, it's moving along. Well, catch you later, sir. 73VK5JP from K90Q.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, you got the right essentials in the fridge. Got to have those tinnies, mate. Yep. All right. 73's Chris, and good to hear you progressing along. And well, hopefully we'll see some more happy snaps. All right. Catch you later. Looks like Chuck's been caught up, so I think there's not much we can do now on that. Yeah, interesting. All right. 73's. Take care.